Hello and welcome to this week's instalment of Nucleus Investment Insights. We have another special guest this week in Brigadier General Robert Spalding. General Spalding has had an accomplished career spanning 25 years with the US Air Force, including being a China strategist for the Chairman of Joint Chiefs of Staff and the Joint Staff at the Pentagon. General Spalding has also earned a doctorate in economics and mathematics. He is fluent in Mandarin and has recently released a book, Stealth War, How China Took Over While America's Elite Slept, which chronicles his experiences and learnings on how the Chinese government has waged a six-front war on America's economy, military, diplomacy, technology, education and infrastructure, and they're winning. Damo.
Yeah, thanks, Tim. Look, this is we obviously run a lot of podcasts every week, and we think every one of them is important. But I think if there's any podcast that we'd urge you to listen to this year, this is the one. We've obviously been speaking a lot about China and issues with technology and technology transfer, and whether having been called out, whether there's going to be investment issues in China. And I really wanted to get General Spalding on and talk about his book, which is a really eye-opening insight into some of the things that's going on. And it's not sort of done by, you know, some random person off the internet who's written a blog or written a post about it. You know, a lot of this sort of gets thrown into conspiracy theories. But, you know, here is somebody who's been senior at the White House, senior in the Pentagon, and, you know, a military attaché to China, giving the inside word and so on what's happening. And I think listeners will find it incredibly insightful on matters like concentration camps, forced technology transfer, organ harvesting, and a range of other factors that you know are going to be critical to the investment case. Anyone who's got a positive investment case for China over the next few years should really sit down and listen to this and work out whether what we're seeing is really a clash of cultures coming to a head.
After the interview, we'll then look at some of the wider investment implications and how these themes can impact how we invest money every day here at Nucleus Wealth. I hope you enjoy. Today on the show, we have an accomplished US Air Force veteran, China strategist, and now author of a damning expose on the shocking success that China has had on infiltrating the American way. General Robert Spalding, welcome to Nucleus Investment Insights.
Thank you. Great to be here.
So General Spalding, just to get our listeners up to speed, would you mind providing us a brief background on yourself and your drive to highlight the stealth war unfolding as you see it?
Well, so first of all, I'm a B-2, was a B-2 stealth pilot in the Air Force. I spent the most of my career flying B-2s and happened back in 2000 to be lucky enough to be selected to go live in China. So I went and learned Chinese for a year at our Defense Language Institute and lived in Shanghai for 2 years from 2002 to 2004 and really got to know the people, the culture, the language really well and really enjoyed my time there. Of course, having this experience as a B-2 pilot and then focus on China really led to, towards the end of my career as I got senior in rank to be a colonel, the Air Force focusing on me being a China expert and particularly going to China to be the defense attaché. So my course of the different positions I had to groom me for that really created some unique opportunities and insights. So I was a senior military fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations in New York and really got to meet a lot of really accomplished people in our country in finance and in venture and hedge funds and really industry captains. I went from there to be the China strategist for the chairman of the Joint Chiefs for 2 years in the Pentagon, and then went to be the senior defense official and defense attaché in Beijing. And while I was there, essentially throughout that process had been working on this emerging competition between the U.S. and China that I describe in my book, and really focused on what the United States needed to do to preserve and protect its democratic republic. And so that led to me being selected to come to the White House and be the senior director for strategy at the White House, where I was the chief architect for the national security strategy. And the book is essentially the story of that, the challenge that we were trying to answer with that 70-page document. And so it provides background and context for the U.S. national security strategy and a lot of the policies that people are beginning to see implemented by the U.S. with regard to China.
Fantastic.
And so it'd be good to go through some of those different sort of elements you sort of cover off in your book. But I guess as a broad brush sort of overview, it seems to us that a lot of the issues America's facing, Australia seems to be facing very much the same issues from a stealth sort of influence growing in our economies and our political system.
Yeah, that's actually right. And, you know, it's really because the system we designed was never meant to have, you know, those nations that essentially repudiate the values and the principles that the system is based on wholeheartedly and yet still be fully connected to that system. And so, you know, for instance, during the Cold War, we didn't really trade with the Soviet bloc. You know, it wasn't really that close a connection in terms of having access to, you know, our capital markets, access to, you know, full trading system, to, you know, access to our university system, our research labs, you know, our politics. There was really, and there's also a suspicion with regard to any contact with the Soviet Union. And so that suspicion and those controls, like things like COCOM, which prevented you know, the Allies from trading with certain technologies with the Soviet Union, all of that, you know, served to reinforce democracies and certainly the market economies that they relied on. And so when at the end of the Cold War, when there was essentially a belief that we no longer had this this world where we needed to protect that system, we essentially threw open the doors and used this idea that if we did, you know, open markets lead to wealth and wealth leads to democracy, that essentially we would change the nations, kind of like China, Russia, North Korea, Iran, Venezuela, Cuba, that are authoritarian, into democracies by allowing their economic development to lead to greater, you know, greater desire by their populations for freedom. And of course, you know, this seemed to work quite well for a while. And in the case of the Chinese, worked well too, up until June 4th, 1989, when the Chinese Communist Party, and this is detailed in the Tiananmen papers, which were internal Communist Party papers that were leaked and translated, actually came out and decided to architect a system that really allowed them to take advantage of openness while promoting a closed system within China.
Yeah, and so if we run through some of the sort of key, you speak about sort of six areas of influence, where I guess China's in a way declared war, but it's not a physical war. Is that's how you're characterizing it? And so maybe we could start with maybe the infrastructure side. What China's doing on the infrastructure side?
Well, there's so much to the infrastructure side, and really there's so much to this. The book is 230 pages, but quite frankly, I could have probably written a 7-volume book, you know. But I tried to keep it, you know, concise, really, because I wanted, you know, people to read it. Nobody wants to read a long book, long, boring book. So in infrastructure, there's quite a bit, actually. So one of the things the thing that's clearly been in the media is this idea that they create these usurious loans for infrastructure as a means of then coming back when the country can't pay for it and taking possession of the asset. This has happened, you know, particularly, for example, with the port, the Hambantota port in Sri Lanka. But, you know, in a larger sense, the infrastructure strategy, if you look at it broadly, is really a way to architect a provision that allows them to have a trading advantage outside of the WTO. And if you look at port economics, for example, it gives you an idea of what I'm talking about. So port economics says that if you double the efficiency at two ports that are connected, that you create the net effect of having the distance between the ports. And so if you looked at where shipping's gone, particularly the Super Panamax ships that, you know, have something like 20,000 TEUs on them or 30,000 TEUs, you know, they get to the docks and it takes forever to unload them. So it requires you to automate the unloading and make it make the unloading process very efficient. And the Chinese ports are, you know, the most efficient ports in the world. And of course, when they own the port, not just in China, but also the port, you know, say on the other side, like, for example, Piraeus in Greece, then it allows them to have an ability to move their goods, more efficiently and effectively, and create a trading advantage just in the physical assets of their system, both in terms of shipping and the infrastructure involved.
But I guess the way you're making it sound there actually sounds like a relatively good thing in terms of saying improving productivity on both ends and all that type of stuff. But I think it's probably more insidious than what you're saying in that, you know, you spoke about the loans to the Sri Lankan port, where the loans were initially to sort of help build and help develop it. But then eventually was Sri Lankans couldn't pay for it. And so then it was like, okay, we'll take it then. Is that a bit more characteristic?
Right. Well, yeah. But then if you look at the Hambantota port itself, it bypasses India. So India doesn't really have a major port that, so in a way it creates this closed trading system that is linked to China. Mm. So it's hyper efficient. So that's another example. Now, when you look at the port of Piraeus and you look at any port, and you look at the land that goes along with the port, there's usually hundreds of acres that go along with the port that allow you to do things like manufacturing. So you can do, you can actually use that as a way to really create an ability to move resources to China to do manufacturing, but also use, the manufacturing for those resources to turn right around and create a market for your economy. So if you expand on that idea and then you look at, for example, in development in Africa, the United States has been in Africa doing developmental projects for decades. But the way the Chinese do development there is fundamentally different. They look at a resource that they need for manufacturing, like, say, for example, cobalt. Cobalt's used for lithium-ion batteries. Cobalt comes from the Democratic Republic of Congo. Okay, so what they'll do is they'll go and they'll build a mine, you know, and essentially build the architecture to connect that mine to a port. And so they'll build rail, they'll build roads, they'll build telecommunications, they'll build power, they'll build water. And when you do all that, you have kind of the skeletal system of an industrialized economy. And if you look at today, the biggest investment in Africa, at 30% from China is low value added manufacturing. So you create the resource to take back to China, but then you begin to create markets. And those markets, so after manufacturing comes urbanization. And when you have all the essentially the pieces of that together in these developing economies, you have the ability now to go to the next level, which is to sell them, you know, $50 smartphones with electronic payments and cameras with artificial intelligence, and you have the ability to go very quickly from a developing economy to a fully connected economy that has all the pieces of the authoritarian control system that is built in China. Mm. So it's a really a phenomenal way. It is a good thing for the developing nations in terms of creating economic growth for those nations, but at the same time, it allows the easy transition from kind of a developing economy authoritarian system to an IT-based authoritarian system that is now wholly connected
and run out of China.
To, to China.
Yeah, and we've got, I don't know how much you look at the Australian one, but, you know, we've got a central case in Australia where the Darwin port was sort of leased to China for 99 yep. years, and the minister who approved it was then retired and then got close to $1 million a year consulting job with the Chinese group that took it out. And I think that's probably part of, you know, what you certainly go into your book is that there's these not direct bribery, but it certainly feels very, very close to the line that's sort of being used against Western nations in terms of those types of how can we get a politician to make a decision that might not be in the country's best interest and then pay them later on.
Yeah, nearly all of these have some kind of corruption tied to them. And usually the agreements are kept secret so that the terms of the loan aren't known. They have things in those contracts, like, for instance, that say your workers will all be able or be required to speak Chinese. And of course, when it comes to fulfilling the work requirements, you have to bring in Chinese employees because you don't have any employees that speak Chinese. So there are things like this that they bake into the contract that then these countries are essentially the benefits that they thought would go to the people just don't really materialize because they bring in Chinese workers to do most of the work. And then, of course, they're paying off the leaders, particularly the authoritarian leaders of the country. And it creates this this tight relationship and fealty, if you will, to the Chinese Communist Party that they're able to then exploit.
Mm. And as you said, we could probably spend the whole podcast talking about the infrastructure.
Right. It's such a broad topic, infrastructure. I don't go into near the things that I told you just now, but they're all part and parcel to, they're things that they are doing that are counter to our interests.
Yeah, sure. And so then maybe jumping to the education sector and seeing what China's doing in the education sector.
Well, I mean, clearly, you've seen this in Australia, where the students from Beijing are counter protesting the students from Hong Kong. Of course, you have the Chinese student associations. You have the Confucius Institutes. Each of these serve to suppress speech on campus, particularly speech that the Chinese Communist Party doesn't like. They also serve as a means of collecting information about the students, what they're doing on campus, and making sure that they don't become, too friendly with democratic principles. And then, of course, providing reinforcement with regard to information exfiltration that the Chinese Communist Party might need. Now, that doesn't mean they're all spies. It just means that, the Chinese Communist Party has two organs in particular, the Ministry of State Security and the People's Armed Police, that they're able to use in China to essentially twist the arms of the families of the children. Also, of course, they turn around and they can and have done to the universities to say, hey, we'll pull all of our kids out. And many times these universities are relying on tuition. And then that serves as a means also of suppression of speech.
Mm. And these Confucius Institutes are generally free from or provided, they're funded by China.
Right. Exactly.
So it seems like a great gift. Yeah. Okay. So that's another big one. We've got a local university suing one of its professors because the professor complained about slipping academic standards to Chinese, and so they're suing him for defamation.
Right. Exactly.
That's
a big danger in Australia because of the laws, and so it can be quite damaging for university professors. I mean, essentially, they intimidate the professors not to speak out.
Mm, absolutely. And then the technology side, and I guess in particular, it's melding into the infrastructure, but, we've spoken a fair bit on our podcast about 5G and the benefits of 5G in terms of, what it's going to do, but maybe you can give a quick your quick overview of what you're think what you're seeing in that area?
Yeah. So if you think about it in terms of the data and kind of forget about 5G for a second and the fact that it's really about expanding the connectivity from 10,000 connections per square mile to 3 million connections per square mile. I mean, we talk about the speed and the latency of the network, but it's really about the increased connections. And if you go back and think about the 4G world, so the 4G world really is a combination of the smartphone as the platform and the 4G network as the pipe. And that really began to materialize in 2007 with the debut of the iPhone. Of course, on the 3G network, the iPhone was really not that great a user experience. But once the 4G networks began to be built, and that was primarily beginning in like 2009, and the two primary countries that did that were Japan and the United States, you really created some interesting dynamics in the economy. So in 2007, when the iPhone comes out, you have the top five in market cap being AT&T, General Electric, Microsoft, ExxonMobil, and Shell. And in 10 years, you go to Facebook, Amazon, Apple, Netflix, Google, and Microsoft. So you fundamentally change the economy. And so much so that the EU creates this global data protection regulation because they're concerned about the privacy of their citizens. And so, the Chinese see this and realize that, hey, they have an opportunity to do the same thing with 5G. Now, the interesting thing about 4G, we'll use just one of the, app services and business models, Uber. And Uber, so, today I took an Uber from my house. I got on my smartphone. I pushed the button. Uber showed up and took me where I wanted to go. So in the 5G world, the idea is that you no longer have to use a smartphone. You walk outside your door, you say Uber, camera picks up your face, reads your lips, or reads a gesture you make, or a microphone picks up your voice. Of course, they know who you are. They know your Uber account because of facial recognition. The car shows up, you get in the car, may or may not have a driver, and takes you where you want to go. All of that data is no longer coming through your smartphone. It's coming through the connected devices on the network. All of this data then begins to be collected even more so than it is now with you and your smartphone. And of course, never mind the fact that today, if you want to opt out of that world, you just decide not to have a smartphone or not to have any of these connected services. What I'm saying is the 5G world really takes away the citizen's ability to opt out of really complete 360-degree surveillance. And then that data, using big data analysis, artificial learning, artificial intelligence, machine learning, and all of the techniques that companies like Facebook and Amazon and Google have used to, sell you more goods for China, really allows their Baidu, Alibaba, and Tencent to become the dominant players in the 5G world. So much like the U.S. Companies, because the U.S. was the first to build a smartphone and 4G networks, dominate today the global data economy. The Chinese are planning to do that with their Baidu, Alibaba, and Tencent. So I think what happens is, and what happened in other industries where they came under pressure from Chinese companies, is that you see these strategic partnerships or forced mergers where essentially these companies are trying to survive. And in particular, I'm talking here about Bell Labs and telecommunications in the United States. It was spun out of AT&T, became Lucent, and then really could not compete with Huawei because, Huawei had was subsidized by the government. But the business...
And the solar industry is a very good example of that.
Exactly.
Just companies were effectively subsidized by the Chinese government to the stage where nobody else anywhere else in the world could compete because...
They're unlimited capital.
Yeah. Everyone else had to make a profit, whereas these guys were happy to run at huge losses to put everyone else out of business.
Right. So the interesting thing about this is when you look at the business models, because all the value is in the data is really the resource that's a strategic resource for the 21st century, then, and because the Chinese Communist Party really controls the entire economy in China, then what it can do in a way that the West can't do is it can take the profits that Baidu, Alibaba, and Tencent makes on having all that data and plow that into building and subsidizing the network. And so where in the United States, AT&T and Verizon are essentially broke because they haven't been able to make money on the $250 billion they invested into 4G networks in the United States. In China, they can say, hey, we're going to take our large tech companies are going to essentially subsidize the network because we want to have access to the data to drive our algorithms over, say, the Facebook, Amazon, Netflix, and Googles. And so it really becomes a key competitive advantage when you can actually own the pipe and subsidize it because it's part of your business model. Of course, and this is where it gets precarious for democracies, and as was released by the Australian Strategic Policy Institute, the paper Engineering Global Consent talks about a company, Chinese company, called Global Tone Communication Corporation, that is a big data AI company in China that does translation and services in 65 languages. Some of its technology is built into Huawei products. This company is jointly owned by the Ministry of Finance and the propaganda arm of the Chinese Communist Party. And so the 2 to 3 petabytes of data it collects per year goes to not just translate languages, but also to the intelligence and influence arms of the Chinese government.
So that's probably a good time to jump. I've got a few more sort of things about the structure, but it's actually probably worth jumping to the some of the stuff you've spoken about in terms of organ harvesting and concentration camps, because at one stage you look and you can sort of say, well, you know, more efficiency and better, and if this is what they're doing to make things to improve the world and lower cost for everyone else, you know, if I get buy lower solar panels, well, and they want to subsidize it, well, that's a good thing in a way. But the flip side is it's who you're really giving it to, isn't it? And that's the so I guess what I'm saying is, if let's say the Australian government wanted to subsidize the whole world's solar panels, most people would go, oh, that's fine. You know, the US will take cheaper solar panels. But the difference with the 5G is, they're using this at the moment to fill the concentration camps of Uyghurs and people of religious the Falun Gong and people of religious backgrounds. And I just wanted to hear from you, what you're seeing in terms of that and some of the organ harvesting that's very 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 concerning, I suppose, for people listening.
Yeah, I think, well, I mean, one of the reasons that the Facebooks of the world have AI research centers in Beijing is because there is no privacy with regard to data, and all the data collected is actually enabled to be used to build their algorithms. And so, as you allude to, what's going on in Xinjiang, and really throughout the country, is what's putting in place is this really massive surveillance system that's also connected to the social credit score, which is designed to essentially automate control of the society. I call it Six Sigma fascism because essentially it seeks to automate suppression of outliers in your society. Outliers are ones that don't conform. And so if you smoke, if you drink, if you gamble, if you jaywalk, if you have the wrong friends, if you speak out about the country, then you can essentially find yourself where you can't get on public transportation. You know, your food costs more. You can't get a loan for your house. Your kids can't get into college. You can't get a job, or you can't get a raise. So all of these things become a way of incentivizing you to be a proper citizen according to the way the Chinese Communist Party wants. And if you think about it, as Chinese companies become dominant around the globe, then this dominance turns into economic and financial relationships that allow them to, you know, transfer this control abroad. And so, you know, I talk about in the book Roy Jones, who was a mid-level employee for the Marriott Corporation, who liked to tweet about Tibet, and the Chinese Communist Party called up and essentially had him fired, and Marriott apologized. This also happened with the NBA. So you're seeing not just the dominance of the global economy by the Chinese, but the fact that with globalization and the internet, the ability to transfer that dominance, economic dominance, into the ability to essentially have individuals obey the writ of the Chinese Communist Party, particularly as it pertains to those things that the party doesn't like people to talk about. Mm.
And so, do you want to talk about some of those things? So, say concentration camps in China. You know, the size and scale that you're seeing there.
Right. Well, I mean, you've got anywhere from 1 million to 3 million Uyghurs, essentially, in a part of China called Xinjiang. Of course, the Uyghurs call it East Turkestan, so it's a minority in a part of the country, quite frankly, that hasn't traditionally been a lot of Han Chinese. The Chinese Communist Party, when it took over China, moved into Xinjiang, took control of the of that area as well. And essentially, things had been going okay for the Uyghurs. Any racial minority is discriminated against by the Chinese government. But what's happened, particularly with the rise of Xi Jinping, has been this effort to essentially eliminate Uyghur culture from Xinjiang. And this has been detailed in 400 pages of internal documents that were essentially leaked from the Chinese Communist Party and translated and released to the New York Times and the Investigative Journalists Association. So, and you can go online now and see where Xi Jinping essentially himself orders the uses of, I think the term is the autocratic state to suppress the religion and culture and language of the Uyghurs.
And Robert, so how far do you think it's got to go before, a broad sort of embargo or something like that? At the moment, it seems to be kicked around. You heard about it sort of quite a few years ago in the early days when people were sort of starting to expose this sort of, behavior and this, what's been happening over there. Do you think it'll ever reach like a tipping point, or do you think we're there now in terms of just a wholesale rejection until something's done about it?
Well, I think it is. I think we are reaching a tipping point. The challenge with this, and the reason that the title of the book, Stealth War, is that because the Chinese Communist Party is one of the most secretive organizations in the world, and because it has the resources and of a nation of 1.4 billion, then it's been very effective, and we've enabled it, in particular the United States with our policies have enabled it. So it's very difficult for people to know what's going on. And most people don't really understand China, and they especially don't understand the Chinese Communist Party. And it's really difficult for anybody that's an outsider to go to China to actually understand what it is to be a Chinese in the Chinese Communist Party system, or to understand what the Chinese Communist Party does and is. And so it's about creating awareness. And as this awareness is created, it begins to create this need for media organizations and others to do research, think tanks in particular, just like as I talked about, ASPE did with Engineering Global Consent. And more information is beginning to come out. So as more information and facts come out, so I believe we have reached a tipping point. I believe the tipping point came in 2017 during the 19th Party Congress, when Xi Jinping was made essentially general secretary for life. Mm. When that happened, I think, in my mind, it really solidified the type of system that the Chinese Communist Party was becoming. And because the country and the party are being so aggressive externally, it is creating this feedback loop where it has to have more and more control because more and more things are being released. And as people become more aware, they begin to create the kinds of agitation in democratic societies that says, we should stop supporting this. Hmm. We should stop supporting, you know, organ harvesting, which I think is probably some of the most horrific things that we've ever heard about in the world.
No, yeah, and I'd love to hear sort of, I know on another podcast, I think I heard you speak about this because, you know, we'd been, I guess, it seemed like it was too horrifying to be true. And I know one of our podcast guests would mention it from time to time. And I'd always add in the word alleged in front because I'd never really seen sort of detailed history of it. But in the last year or so, some of that's come out, hasn't it? And I think you spoke about that in one of your podcasts. And I'd love to hear that our listeners to hear that from your mouth.
Well, yeah. So the gentleman that led the war crimes tribunal against Slobodan Milosevic led a UK tribunal on forced organ harvesting of prisoners of conscience in China, and that report was released this year. And it really, they interviewed hundreds of people, including some of the doctors that were performing the surgeries. Of course, there's been this huge organ transplant, industry in the United States or in China that has, you know, amounted to the tune of billions of dollars. And yet there is no real sense of this idea of organ donorship in China. In fact, there's not the type of system that exists in other nations where people can voluntarily decide to donate their organs. So when researchers began to look at this, they said, okay, where all of these surgeries are happening, but there's no organ donorship system in China like in other countries. So where are they getting the organs? That's when they began to realize that they were coming from prisoners. And of course, you know, it's one thing when you've got, you know, a murderer on death row, but say you've got a Uyghur who, if you look at some of the documents that I talked about, who basically, you know, had a beard or refused to drink alcohol because, again, the Chinese Communist Party wants to eradicate their culture, and so finds himself in a prison for 3 years. And this three-year prison sentence, he gets a blood type, he gets his tissue type, and then he gets an ultrasound on his organs. And as he's waiting in for his three-year sentence to play out, he gets put on an organ donor match list. And somebody, either in some leader in the country or somebody from outside the country willing to pay, you know, the fee, which, you know, can range anywhere from $75,000 to $250,000, depending on what organ it is, says, hey, I need an organ. They make an appointment. They schedule an appointment. In fact, if you go and look on, it's been shown that there's actually organ donor lines in customs when you're in Border Patrol, when you're going to Xinjiang, that you can go through if you're getting a transplant. And they'll go there and they'll schedule this surgery. So they'll take this prisoner who's up for a three-year sentence, they'll hook him up to an ECMO machine, which is a machine that essentially oxygenates the organs to keep them alive. And then while the person's alive, they'll proceed to take out the organs and transfer them over to be donated to the person that comes in. And so what happens is once the person's done donating the organs, they're thrown in the incinerator. And so this is the kind of thing that the UK tribunal said, well, this has all the characteristics of genocide because they're trying to eliminate the Uyghur culture. But the one thing that genocide, the definition of genocide doesn't have is for profit. And so they didn't call it genocide, but clearly when you look at what they're doing in combination of, you know, creating a business for organ transplants in China and getting rid of their prison population, which they quite frankly don't want anyway, it really just creates this convenient way for them to answer a problem and make a profit at the same time. And therein, in a microcosm, lies the kind of challenge with the communist system, because there's no morals in the system.
Mm. And so that's, and again, this is another topic we could spend ages on. So I'll sort of leave it at that, but what I really wanted to impress on our readers, listeners, is, you know, we're not talking about benevolent countries, you know, donating, you know, shutting down industries and giving everyone else cheaper things. What we're actually talking about is a system trying to get control over these factors. And so part of that then comes back to, you speak a bit in the book about the accounting standards and some of the capital controls. So I guess the devil's bargain China's making to Western country companies is, hey, come and access our $1.5 billion worth of, well, sorry, 1.5 billion population, but we're not going to let you take the money back out the other side. And then also on the flip side, then for investors who want to invest in Chinese companies is, yes, you can come and invest in them, but there's actually no accounting. We won't conform to Western accounting standards, and we won't actually give visibility over what's within the companies. And those companies have a first you know, the
priority.
First priority is, yep, to the Chinese Communist Party.
Yeah, I mean, this is the thing that is really, you know, it's baffling. So, for example, I'm retired from the military now, but, you know, a year ago when I was in the military, I had a retirement account. It was called the Thrift Savings Plan, where I had been putting money in my account. In 2020, the board this year, the board voted of that Thrift Savings Plan board voted to begin sending $3.3 billion, I think, of those funds into China for companies like the Aviation Industry Corporation in China, which I think is the number two defense contractor in China. And so me being a B-2 pilot, my retirement's now going in to fund the production of J-20s, which would, you know, essentially be a raid against B-2s. So in a way, it's adding insult to injury when you realize that Aviation Industry Corporation of China isn't required by the Securities and Exchange Commission or the PCAOB, the auditing oversight arm of the SEC, to actually comply with audit and transparency requirements like other U.S. or Australian or European companies have to. And so, you know, they don't have, and if you understand Chinese accounting, they usually say there's three or four sets of books, one for the tax collector, one for the owner of the company, so they know what's actually going on, and one if it's going to do a U.S. IPO, one for the IPO. So their accounting standards are whatever, you know, according to whatever they want them to be.
Yeah, absolutely. And the legal ownership isn't the same as well in terms of, you're not getting the same as you've got a share in Australia. If I get my 10 cent share taken away from me, my legal recourse is a lot less than what I'd find anywhere else. So yeah, so certainly those issues. The other one actually as well, because it's just aware of your limited time, that another story from your book that I thought was fascinating. You know, I think we've all obviously heard lots and lots of stories about hacking and corporate espionage in terms of Chinese companies coming in and stealing secrets. But I thought you had a great anecdote within the story about the private equity company and changing sales orders and things like that, that I think our listeners would love to hear. And as sort of an example of the types of detail you go into in your book.
Yeah. Well, I mean, this was kind of the beginning of my journey when I really, as I opened that briefing, as I talk about in my book, I'm sitting in my office in the Pentagon, and I opened this briefing. It's from one of the top auditing firms in the United States, and it had vignette after vignette where, you know, essentially China had gone after a company in many different industries and put them under duress in order to gain some kind of advantage for a purpose. And the case that I talk about in the book, a $3 billion, I think it was, chemical company. It was on a 5-year arc to IPO, year 4, where they were going to IPO the company in year 5. Company's doing great. And then all of a sudden, they get a 2-3% decrease in sales and a 2-3% decrease in logistics or cost of goods sold. And they fire their sales manager. They get their leadership team together and start to clean things up. And then lo and behold, within a short amount of time, they get an unsolicited offer for the company at 30% below value. Now, The interesting thing about that 30% below value price is that it exactly corresponds what you would be valuing the company at given the decline in performance. And so the private equity company...
It wasn't public.
Yeah.
What's the performance that? Wasn't public.
No, it wasn't the public. Performance wasn't public. So nobody knew about... The only ones that knew about the decrease in performance was the private equity company that owned it. And so now they got suspicious because how could this company value this so precisely? So they called in the auditing company. Of course, not only had the company been hacked, but the private equity company had been hacked. Private equity company had kind of red lines, if you will, to say that we've got a problem. And those were about 2-3% on each of those metrics. And so because the Chinese knew about that, they were able to keep the decline in performance from triggering one of those alerts. And essentially what they were doing is on sale. So as bids would go out from the company for jobs, every once in a while, those bids would never materialize because they'd be pulled out of the email server. So, but just enough so that they didn't bust that 2-3% threshold. And the same thing on cost of goods sold. If they had 1,000 units of output order that they needed to do, they would get 900 units at the warehouse and have to order another 100 units at increased cost. So that would increase their cost of goods sold. And so what the Chinese wanted there was some green technology that was in the company. And so they were going to buy the company and dismantle it and take the technology back to China. But it just story after story after story like that, where nobody knew, there's nobody that I could go to in the government that could say that understood that this was going on so pervasively across our economy. And nobody really in national security really understands how private equity or industry works or how these things, affect our national security. And really nobody was working on it. And so that really... That's where the book really kicks off in terms of where I start to, and I had a team of China experts at the Pentagon, where we just began to start to peel back the layers of the onion to see how deep the rot went. And, so what I'm happy to announce that I haven't reached the end of it. I keep peeling the onion.
Yeah. Well, that's, and that was the thing for me is I think, we'd certainly heard stories about hacking and stuff like that, and you tended to think of it along as somebody jumps in, steals the blueprints and makes off, right. Or somebody denial of service attacks and brings down a server. But it's obviously way more concerning for everyone when it's like no, we're jumping in doing very subtle things when we're doing them only up to a certain limit. If we pulled every sales order, then someone would notice.
Yep.
So we're just pulling every 10th one or every 15th one or just modifying, as you said, making it 900 units rather than 1,000 units. And so the customer gets the wrong order, you got to send it out again. There's, sand in the wheels as opposed to breaking the whole machine.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it was really, I thought it was incredible. Just really impressive. Mm-hmm. And it just shows a level of skill, not in just an industry sense, but also on how to do business and finance in a way that really is almost, so subtle that unless you really understand that the thing that really, I think, shocked the private equity company was how could they value it so precisely? So, I mean, clearly, it was somebody that was an expert at private equity that was helping in this effort.
Mm. And I think Australia has certainly seen its fair share of takeovers where companies with good pipelines into China, and then all of a sudden, there's licensing issues or there's product issues or there's something that all of a sudden their sales fall because their sales to China suddenly. Get stymied and then lo and behold, here comes a takeover bid at 40% more than what the share price is trading at, but 50% less than what the share price was a year before. So
powdered milk companies seem to be a bit of a hot favorite in Australia because we've got a good strong dairy industry and Chinese.
I mean, the rail industry was destroyed by the Chinese. The Australian rail industry, it's gone.
Absolutely. I've got a friend who's there working on working within China, and it was just that part where went from everything being manufactured here to nothing being manufactured there. And because it was, and he, when he first went over, he was spoken to awe about how they'd basically built a whole city that, you know, 5 million people you'd never heard of, where they just had, you know, yards and yards and yards of rail yards, where, but no orders yet. They just built, basically gone, well, if we can get our cost down low enough, we can just half the cost of everyone else, and we bring them all on board, and then where can they go? Okay. So as you said, you know, I guess you said it's peeling back the layers of the onion. So that was sort of one question I was coming back. There certainly seems over the last while to be just a steady stream of these stories coming through, and I guess I'd be interested to see Trump's you know, spoken a bit about trying to bring back more business to America from a nationalistic point of view. But is there much sort of pressure from, security agencies within US or in other countries to try and convince other political leaders to do that same thing and to make it more of a security issue, to turn this into a, as you said, less of an economic issue and more of a security issue for countries?
It is, but, you know, we're still at the kind of the nascent stages of that, you know, because I think national security professionals clearly don't have the kind of sophistication that they need to really understand how business and industry works. And quite frankly, even business and industry don't realize that you can take a thing that is very distributed, like in the way we think about things, and then really centralize it. And it's really not about how the Chinese Communist Party, you know, tells people what to do. What they do is they set the incentive system in a way that unlocks innovation in very negative ways, you know, just like the organ harvesting thing, and says, hey, you can make a profit just as long as you don't, you know,
tell anyone about it.
Yeah, challenge the party. You don't challenge the party. You can do whatever you want in China. And so one of the things that they do is, you know, take their pharmaceutical factories and make fentanyl. Fentanyl is a highly, powerful opioid that kills people, and ships it to the United States and really around the world. And so, you know, the countries that are getting that stuff, they say, well, can you stop? And the Chinese say, well, you know, we can't really do much about that. So, but this is a kind of behavior when you have a communist system that is fully enmeshed in an open, globalized, internet-connected world, when they basically don't agree with any of the principles or values that world was founded upon.
And you would think, I mean, I would think that if you're in a country that limits the way you're allowed to think in all these different areas, and then says, now I'd like you to go and be really innovative about creating new technology, it's quite difficult in that, you know, people need certain freedoms, and they need, you know, it's very hard to tell someone, we want you to be, yeah, as I said, really creative in one area, but groupthink everywhere else.
That's where you can get talent from, you know, you can get talent to come from the US or from Australia, and they'll pay enormous sums to these people, you know, like they had NASA scientists helping them make hypersonic missiles, because, you know, we've allowed that in our system. The benefit of us to be used by them to essentially promote what they're doing.
And I'm assuming that, you know, NASA, you know, while it probably pays not too bad for a senior scientist, I'm sure you can get a hell of a lot more money on the open market selling those secrets to China.
Mm. Certainly.
Right. And so since you published the book, there's, as you said, the, you know, NBA came out, and it's sort of its reaction, I suppose, is positive and negative in a way. It stood up. It didn't actually fire its employee, but sort of had to back down and then stand back up again and then back down again. And so I guess in a way that's almost – does that seem like it's almost been pushed too far? The Chinese pushing too far, and now there's a bit of a pushback against it?
Definitely. And the thing is that as the more this goes, because they're trying to essentially control their external environment and their domestic population – but as the pressure mounts, as more is become known about the Chinese Communist Party, they're just squeezing ever tighter, and in doing so, they create more problems for themselves. You know, they're now the ambassadors of different countries are threatening countries if they don't build, you know, their they don't allow Huawei to build their 5G networks. You know, the they're threatening these countries. And so this will continue until, you know, democracies essentially wake up and say, okay, no more. And I think that is beginning to happen. You know, I just came back from a trip to Europe last month, where essentially the EU is completely flipped on understanding the threat to democracy that the Chinese Communist Party now poses to the free countries of Europe. So this is just going to accelerate, I think, as time goes on. I think where we'll have the most competition is going to be in the emerging market economies, where the Chinese are essentially paying them off to get them to cooperate.
Yeah, exactly. And a lot of those countries will have less transparency into government processes. Right. And so those things can sort of go unseen as opposed to countries like Australia, where it pops up and, yeah, we can, yes, the trade minister ends up with a, you know, $1 million contract, and it sort of makes at least the second or third page of the newspaper.
Right.
And the trade deal, I guess, how much do you think Trump is has this in mind in terms of, like, there's obviously an economic argument, but there's also this moral argument and security argument. In public, he seems to talk a lot about the economic argument. How much in behind the scenes do you think is on the security or the moral side of the?
His most trusted cabinet official is Secretary Pompeo. And if you listen to what Pompeo is saying, it's all about the human rights, civil liberties, democratic principles that essentially the Chinese Communist Party repudiates, that the United States needs to focus on. And so it's almost like a 1-2 combination. You know, the president is really focused on kind of realist policies, you know, power, and the Secretary of State is focused on idealist policies with regard to principles and values. And I think it's actually a good way to break those two responsibilities up, because you can have, I think, you know, a good foreign policy really essentially grows the power of a country so that it can protect its own interests, and at the same time, you know, has values that it stands for in the international order.
Mm. And just sort of aware of your time, because I know I could spend another hour easily talking with you, but just you know, conscious of your time, I guess one of the key things you have in your book as well, just to sort of finish up on, one of the key things you have in your book is this, you talk about 3-year timetable that you think that countries have to stand up and protect democracy, to avoid being, I guess, white-anted. Do you want to talk, maybe, have you got some sort of milestones that you think that'll be signs that we're moving in the right direction, or milestones that you worry that we're moving in the wrong direction?
Yeah, so, I mean, the timeline I had in there really has begun to shift, because I see the right kind of behavior happening. So tariffs, the implementation of tariffs, and the consistency there, and other protections. I think as the more awareness comes, as the Chinese Communist Party is exposed, it becomes harder for them. You know, so kind of what's happening now is there's being sand thrown in their gears for the first time, and for first time in I think over 3 decades. And so as that happens, their ability to dominate the international system, you know, begins to be challenged. And as that happens, this 3-year window begins to increase. And it's really providing us an opportunity to kind of get our house in order, to invest in our people, in science and technology, and research and development, and infrastructure, industrial base, and really protect the institutions of the openness. And really focus on building out secure networks that actually protect citizens' data. I think these are all things that we need to get busy doing. And because the Chinese Communist Party is essentially being exposed, that we have more time to do that. But, you know, that window is only going to be open for so long, because, quite frankly, if we don't really focus on the things that are important to us, we could easily see our freedoms being lost in some kind of dystopian future.
Absolutely. Well, look, thank you very much. I really appreciate the work you're doing and taking the time to speak with us.
Yeah, thanks, Robert. So obviously your book, Stealth War, How China Took Over While America's Elite Slept, is available out now on Amazon. We'll put a link in the show notes for you. Just on a finishing note there, what's in front of you? What have you got your eye on? What are you going to be doing post the release of your book and obviously the media circus?
Yeah, so for the next year, 2020, I'm just going around and talking about the book as much as possible. So a Polish language version was just released in Poland. I just got back from there. A Chinese language version is being released. I'm looking to really get this message out there because I want democracies to prevail. I want our Democratic Republic to prevail. And I think the easiest way to do that is to make people aware and then let them in their own way, in both in terms of as individuals, but then as nations, begin to do the things that actually provide for the protections that we need.
Fantastic. We'll look forward to following your work, and with any luck, we might get you on back on the show sometime soon. Thanks very much, General Spalding.
Fantastic. Thank you.
So, Damien, a insightful and illuminating 50-odd minutes spent there with General Spalding. What were your thoughts?
Yeah, look, I've been wanting to get him on for a couple of months now, ever since I saw him interviewed elsewhere and his book came out and read his book. We've had this view for a while that the genie's out of the bottle at the moment, and that in terms of China, and that companies would no longer be pushing as much of their supply chain across to China as you can. And I've spoken a few, and he spoke around exactly what I, exactly some of my talking points from before, was that you would never consider outsourcing your entire supply chain to Russia. Mm. And Russia is actually a democracy, in at least notionally.
Yep.
But companies have been more than willing to outsource pretty much their entire supply chain to China for the cost. And so China's got itself into this position where traditionally, democratic countries will trade with non-democratic countries for things like commodities and very low value items. And China's got itself in this position where it's actually doing a lot of higher value items and trying to push further up.
Right.
And our view's been that unless you see a political change in China, and we've been seeing the opposite, is that they've been regressing, as General Spalding spoke about, that you're actually going to have to start to see a change in, you are, sorry, not have to, but you will start seeing a change in the way companies are trading it. And our view is, over the last year that's happened, mm-hmm. and that companies are actively looking to move their supply chains out of China. And regardless of whether you get a trade deal or not, version one, version two, or whatever one comes through, that this is a trend now that won't stop, and that you'll see security agencies, you'll see people from a moral perspective pushing in this direction. And as we spoke before, we're not talking about some kook from the internet. This is a senior military attaché to China, and senior in the White House, senior in the Pentagon. It's not not a conspiracy theory.
As real as you can get.
Yeah, that's right. As much as you'll see stuff come out from China to muddy the waters and play that whole game of, no, it didn't happen, this didn't happen, this is as good as information as you're going to get on this. And so, our view is that that's going to keep happening. So what we're looking for very much is companies that that do benefit as companies move their supply chains out of China, mm-hmm. whether it be in some of the other sort of surrounding countries, or whether it be probably prefer companies that are doing a lot of automation or logistics and supply chain type moving factors.
Yep.
Less about the actual transporting, more about the setting up new factories and setting up new systems in terms of China. So we think it's very much coming to a head.
Yep.
We think that the last few years has been it's been bubbling away, but now the rubber's starting to hit the road. And if you don't sort of get onto this trend, you wake up in 5 years' time wondering why some Chinese industrial company you bought a few years ago hasn't done anywhere near as well as what you thought it would. The other thing to come out of that is, as I alluded to, and he goes into in his book, he goes into a lot more detail. We really only just touched on it in the interview, but accounting standards in China, companies don't have to report to the same accounting standards as what they do in Western countries, and they don't get audited by Western auditing companies. You don't have the same ownership rights. There's a lot of other factors. There's some very, very senior billionaires in China who have had their shares effectively taken away from them, or sold them back at peppercorn prices back to the Chinese Communist Party.
Right.
It's a making a huge investment in China is a dangerous game, and you know that you don't want to be up and dancing when the music stops.
Yep.
So I guess what we're looking for, what we're suggesting is, you know, the never-ending growth story that you get out there, that, you know, China's got a 1.4 billion people, they're moving to middle class, never-ending growth, I've got to invest as much as I can in China, isn't supported, and unless you see, by their political system.
Yep.
And, you start seeing a crackdown on technology transfers, and you start seeing more security security measures put in place by countries to stop that technology transfer, that you won't see that same growth, and that next level of growth to go from quite a poor country to being
middle income
is quite easy, but you get caught in what they call the middle income trap.
Yep.
And I think it's pretty clear that the US and moving on to Europe and other countries now are determined that unless China changes, they're going to get stuck in that middle income trap.
What are your thoughts as well? China's, I think, are looking to be added to the MSCI Emerging Index, and they're probably going to be
added to that MSCI Emerging Markets Index. Look, the thing to note on the Emerging Market Index is that it is an artificial construct. So you get the biggest company in it is Samsung.
Okay.
So most people would say, well, Samsung's a global, you know, telephone manufacturer, you know, in Apple's space.
Yeah, absolutely.
And well in front of most other companies.
Yep.
So it's not really an emerging
company. Yeah, yep.
So by the same token, if you're just trying to if you try to throw your money at emerging markets and you're saying, oh, I'm just going to take an index of what I'm getting, then you're going to end up with a bunch of Chinese state-owned entities. Mm-hmm. You're going to end up with a bunch of Russian oil companies. You're going to end up with, you know, a whole mixed bag of companies you probably don't think you're going to get.
Yeah, right.
And so I would urge people who do want to invest in emerging markets. We don't. We run sort of core portfolios here in just large developed markets. We're sort of running, I guess, the more boring portfolios is how we like to say it.
With good accounting standards.
Exactly. Large blue, you know, we're there to try to protect the money. If you're looking for a bit of excitement and you really want to stray into those, then find somebody who knows what's going on, and find somebody who's got... who's doing the fundamental research, because within those countries and in particular China, you can invest in a stock and the guy's on the wrong side of the political, the guy who owns it's on the wrong side of the political divide that happens, and next thing you know, your company's worthless.
Just rubbed out.
Yeah. Yep. So, lots and lots of caution if you want to invest in that area.
Mm-hmm.
And it's worth noting as well, within our portfolios, we do have ethical screens as well where people can look and cut out countries that aren't democratic or that have, you know, we've got a number of different ways you can look at it in terms of the ethics of countries in terms of rule of law and accounting standards. So you can actually put an over the top of your own portfolio in our system, you can put that on so that you definitely don't end up with any of those companies.
Okay, Damien, fantastic. And for those listening in, if you've got a bit of time over the Christmas break, feel free to head over to www.nucleuswealth.com and check out all our information and recent blogs and podcasts. You can also check out what an investment looks like for you through our onboarding portal. It takes no more than about 10 minutes to get a full picture of exactly what we can do for you. You can invest in basically any structure. We obviously offer all the transparency and utilize the themes that you've been listening to throughout the year in these portfolios. Welcome you to check it out, and feel free to be in touch if you have any questions. Well, that's it for now, and thanks for watching. If you like what you heard today and you'd like to hear more, head over to nucleuswealth.com/subscribe. Give us your email address, and in return, we'll send you a weekly email with new webinar topics, links for our podcasts, and other news from Nucleus Wealth. I certainly hope you've got something out of today, as I have, and we'll look forward to catching you at the next one. Cheers.